Welcome to Middlebrow, a service of Scriptorium Daily. This is John Mark Reynolds, one of the last times that I'll get to say all of that as I move on to be provost at Houston Baptist. And the team here at Torrey, the leadership team that has done such a fabulous job actually running things the last 7 or 8 years, moves us further up and further in here at the Torrey Honors Institute. The series of 3 to 4 shows that we're doing right now are a little bit of a retrospective on the last 17 years of Torrey. So if you're not a Torrey insider or you don't care, there's a warning. We're going to wax a little nostalgic in the next little bit. I'm here with my normal colleagues in crime, Paul Spears. Say hi to your mom, Paul.
Hi to your mom, Paul.
And Fred Sanders.
Hello, I am Fred Sanders.
If people are interested, we talked a little bit about the philosophy behind the founding of Torrey, less about the history, bringing in those first 32 students, sitting up here on the second floor of Sutherland. I remember talking to them, meeting them for the first time. Very golden moment. People like Josh Blander, Paul Spears, Thomas Lizo that I had met through the MA philosophy program or just from going to church here in the area, who were kind of floating around and would do a class or two. But for those first 2 years, I would say I taught 80 to 90% of the classes. Certainly the first year I taught or was at every single class. So those poor students would have me 3 to 4 times a
week.
Let's
just say they've been imprinted.
Yes. And if you're bitter out there, I'm sorry about that. I did the best I could.
But the original vision for the program was to be the size of one teacher.
Yes, that's exactly right. That's what Biola wanted to do because I will tell you the truth. There were faculty, not administrators, who said things like, Biola just doesn't attract tier one students, rank one students. We're a poor school and we're always going to be a poor school. Now, I think that was wrong. I don't think Biola was poor before Torrey came, but there was some defeatist perception amongst better faculty members on campus. And yes, bells go off everywhere in this office. If you've had class here, you know that that's true. So as we think about the early history of Torrey, Biola started wanting 16 total students. That would have been viewed as success. I was looking for 16 applicants to kind of weed down to 4. We ended up with, I think, 80 or 90 applications. And Biola let me admit, 36 students, or 36 students came out of the 40 that we admitted. And about 32 of those students graduated.
And you called every single person that was on that big list.
That's right. Up to this point, except the semester I took a sabbatical, and this semester after I decided to go in, I've interviewed every student that's applied to Torrey. So there's no student that's come to Torrey until very recently or the semester I took the sabbatical who isn't named Reynolds.
They're actually, graduating this year. That group of students.
That group of students. So it's been an exciting process. Got to know a lot of students.
Well, I want to ask in a minute about how things got so big and out of control if it was just supposed to be 16 students right. in the first place. But first, why did you come here? You're from Virginia and New York, and
It's West Virginia, by the way.
Yeah,
Virginia. West Virginia is
the other side of the Mississippi.
Union part of it. Yeah, out there. How do you end up in California? It's a good question because I was very much an East Coast person. My family did live in Virginia, West Virginia for 400 years. So it's not as if being on the East Coast was new to us.
You're not a Biola alum.
Yeah, I had never heard of Biola.
Okay.
Until I started
you kept
working
thinking Loyola?
Here. Yeah, I did. I thought I was going to Loyola the first time I flew out here because I had no picture of Biola in my head at all. And I think that's true of a lot of the United States. We're the number one name brand for sure west of the Mississippi. But sadly, east of the Mississippi, people think of the rest of the United States, like flyover country and Los Angeles. They don't have a good map of what's going on the West Coast. So how did I end up here? Mm-hmm. Well, I was sitting at the University of Rochester, finishing up my PhD in philosophy and struggling with work and other things and had gone through a dark time in my personal life and had come out of that and was doing well with the Lord and walking along trying to defend the traditional Christian faith and heard a guy named Phil Johnson debating a woman named Eugenie Scott on National Public Radio. I love listening to NPR just because it makes me think and often makes me mad. And I thought, this Phil Johnson guy, this lawyer at Berkeley, that's finally the right way to talk about creation and evolution. And it happened that that day I had received an offer, like everyone did back then, from a free company called America Online.
Which would give you a disc in the mail?
Yes, that's right.
Nice.
They would give you internet access and something called email at AOL.com.
Wait, so I just have to stop you for a second and say, so part of the starting of Tori can be attributed to National Public Radio.
Yes.
And America Online.
Yes, that's
okay. I'm
that's,
just being clear that's
correct.
Where we're going. Okay.
And so once I got an email address, I actually had no one to write, because even in grad school in the 90s, you didn't really send a lot of email. I had an email address at Rochester. I never used it. And so
is this 1994, 1995?
Yeah, it would be 96.
Okay.
And you could get by without email in the mid-90s. People used it. I actually taught a class online on my Commodore computer, and so I knew about online stuff, but you didn't have to use it as part of work. It was like a hobby. So the fact that I understood online was only because I was a hobbyist, not because I was in university.
So you got on your ham radio and talked to Phil Johnson.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, I actually didn't talk to Phil because I didn't know his email address. Again, you couldn't just go on the internet. Browsers didn't exist. But Paul Nelson, that very day, had sent me a letter, and in his snail mail letter, he had included an email address. So I sent Paul an email. I had nothing to say to this other doctoral student other than this Phil Johnson
this
guy is awesome.
Could not at all be divine providence.
Yeah,
or
not
like
at
that.
All. And so he said, oh, well, Phil has an email address. You should send him a letter. And Phil and I began a correspondence that now in that closet is probably 50 notebooks of printout if you printed it out. Wow. We just wrote every day back and forth. And Phil asked, how are you doing with your doctoral program? I said I could use some support. And I really could. And he helped, through Howard and Roberta Amundsen, arrange for a postdoc.
Now, one of the reasons Phil Johnson thought you were interesting is, of course, your ideas and the things you were arguing in public about creation. And
yeah, I had been published already.
Intelligent
on those
design,
issues.
Though, they might not have called it that.
Yeah, they didn't call it an intelligent design. I was, and still am, a young Earth creationist, but I was a very weird young Earth creationist in that I'd often go to young Earth creationism meetings and offend all the creationists and the Humanist Association. You could look this up. The National Center for Science Education was a fan. They'd often write nice things about me in the sense that I wanted good arguments to be made, and sometimes young earthers didn't make them. Mm-hmm. And I would be the skunk at the party and say, these are bad arguments.
Now, the other thing that caught Phil Johnson's eye is you had a quirky email address.
Yeah, I was Mary Took, because I know Mary wasn't a Took, but I thought I'm a descendant.
And then your
of
next
the
email address, or you signed your name Nick Romanoff. Right,
right, that's right. It was back in the era where you had eccentric email addresses and you were allowed to do that.
So you had this sort of Slavophile, Tolkien-esque persona.
Which was
so
perfect for Phil, it turns out. Yeah. All you're doing is pointing out that I'm crazy because I gave you a hard time about knowing about Plastic Man.
Yeah, so
on the
Phil
last
Johnson
show.
Had to somehow become convinced that you were crazy enough to be interesting, but also stable and responsible.
Dangerous.
Right.
There's this some magic zone that,
yeah,
that
so
appealed.
He flew me out to what I thought was Loyola, where he was giving a series of lectures. I showed up at what I thought was Loyola, turned out to be Biola. Went up into the president's office where he was meeting with J.P. Moreland. Well, J.P. Moreland, if you were in philosophy in the era I was a kind of folk hero, a legend. I kept his book, Christianity and the Nature of Science, by my bed as a kind of talisman. The top cover is faded. When I found out that J.P., who was actually my age now at that time, so a relatively up-and-coming still scholar at really publishing like a machine at that point and a role model for those of us in philosophy, was here at Biola. Then I went to Phil and said, hey, instead of staying in Rochester, what if I come out here and do this postdoc, which is funded in any case, through Biola? They can take care of Social Security and things like that. And to his infinite credit, the provost here, Sherwood Lingenfelter, had been thinking about doing postdocs. And even though I wasn't quite finished with my doctorate until halfway through the first year of the two-year postdoc, he was able to be innovative enough, think outside the box, that there was a giant convergence of things. And I ended up here at Biola, with really no responsibilities except to finish my doctorate, travel around with Phil, carry his luggage, and also be mentored by J.P. Moreland, who took me to Disneyland a lot, got me involved in a Three Views of Creation and Evolution project, had me teach some classes to the strangest group of students I'd ever had. They included Tom Crisp, Josh Blander, a guy named Paul Spears, who knows who that is, Jeff Lehman, and I'll point out all
and
four
Greg
of those,
Tenelsoff?
And Greg Tenelsoff. All five of those people have tenure-track jobs in philosophy. I didn't know how lucky I was to have such a great group of students. So that was my first experience at Biola, and it was a place that believed in inerrancy and would allow a young Earth creationist to work as long as I did responsible work. So I fell deeply, madly in love with Biola, have stayed deeply, madly in love with Biola ever since.
But part of this might be the fact that, John Mark, you were working on your doctorate and had time to burn.
Yeah, that's
in the way in which you do that.
I have never had less responsibility at any point in my life.
Which can only lead to trouble or then, something good.
That's right. Then in the year before Tori was started. And so part of what I did was I just volunteered and taught a whole bunch of classes like Intro to Philosophy here because I enjoyed it. They were really clear. There are no jobs in philosophy. We have lots of philosophers on campus. I said I don't want to work at a Christian college because I want to change the world for Jesus and do this strange St. Anne's on the Hill where we're all going to think about great books. But in the middle of all that process, having fallen in love with Biola, having had the best students in my MA, you know, Phil class, and when you're talking about Tom Crisp, who's maybe the leading metaphysician in the world, Paul Spears, who knows more about philosophy of education than anybody I know, you know, Greg Tenelsoff, who until recently was the chair of the Biola Philosophy Department, Jeff Lehman, who's a Thomas Aquinas, award-winning book writer, Dan Yim, who's now teaching philosophy and taught for us for a long time in Torrey at Bethel, right? University. I didn't realize how spoiled I was. But I also thought, well, Biola is going to change the world for Jesus. Maybe we should do something here like M.A. Phil for undergraduates. And really, that's why Tori ended up at Biola in California, even though I had no association with it. And Phil Johnson had no association. Phil is now half of Tori is named after Phil Johnson. And his papers will end up in the library here. He wants to give his papers to the library here. But all of that was through a kind of weird, providential, God bringing things together. And Howard and Roberta Amundsen, who are just falsehoods are told about them all over the internet and are the most generous, warm, compassionate people amongst them that I've met, they had the temerity to count on this little project and fund it for 2 years. After 2 years, we were making money for the university, and so we were able to sustain ourselves.
Now, let's go back to you talked Biola into giving you 16 students with some sort of an agreement like, well, it's only 16 and I can't mess them up that bad and
right.
It's something to keep me out of trouble.
Right, that's right.
But then, what did you say, 80 applied?
Yeah, that's right.
Because part of it was, would anyone even sign up for this?
Yeah, I think 90-odd applied. I think the one benefit and one thing that attracted me to Paul Spears, you know, why Paul Spears is one of the first employees, was because I had actually spent a year working as a life insurance salesman and a financial planner for Metropolitan. And I learned a lot about business during that time period. And Paul also had a sharp business background. And so what I wanted Biola to do was give me the blue bars at that time when they printed out computer information. They didn't give it to you online because, again, online hardly existed.
Right.
They would do a massive printout of all the students interested in Biola with the right SAT scores, the right GPA. And my job was to call every single one of them and convince them that they wanted to read Homer and talk about him Socratically. And so I did that. I probably made hundreds of calls. I don't want to exaggerate. And our rate of acceptance was about what you'd expect. It was probably about 10% of the students I actually called applied, but they made me stop because at some point they had 90 applications for a program they wanted 4 or 5 applications for. and so that's been our problem ever since, right?
So then you admitted more than twice what you were your mandate was to admit.
So you were able to talk them into letting you have ever. That.
You brought in 36.
Yeah, yeah. The first class.
Oh, but you're saying the thought was you would talk four or five people into doing this.
That's correct.
Every year.
Every year.
For a total of 16 enrolled at any given time.
So they would never need to have more than one person or one and a half people
so
employed in their honors college.
It initially got out of control when you were allowed to admit 36
yes,
in 1 year.
Which meant, for sure, there were going to be four people permanently employed in Torrey. Though because I'm not sure that it was ever really clear to any of my bosses that that was true. It sort of evolved in that direction.
But these were all good thinkers capable of doing math.
Yes, that's right. So I'm sure Sherwood knew it. But, you know, and I'm sure that Clyde Cook, to his infinite credit, knew what was going on. But right.
But there
I mean,
are infrastructure implications.
Every year when I would say, if we keep admitting this many students, I'm going to need a new employee, they would say, we're not sure whether you're going to stay open. Right. This is an experiment. It was 3 or 4 years before we were sure we would exist.
So immediately you needed to multiply your teaching ability.
Yeah,
by
the
finding...
second year we hired quite a few adjuncts, including Paul, I think. You started doing secretarial work. Josh Blander, I know, taught right away.
Here's how I ended up doing secretarial work, because you walk into a room and there's stuff everywhere and you can't take it anymore.
Yeah,
and
so I was
you start
the original Tory
so
secretary.
You start just organizing. And so the fact that you call me that just meant that I thought, huh, someone should file this.
There are things on the floor.
There are things on the floor. We should, you know, trash goes in the trash
Paul,
can.
Paul, the amount
like that
the amount that I owe you, including the number of Diet Pepsis at that time that I owe you, is incalculable. Because
that was back when it was a Pepsi campus.
Yes, it
wow.
was a Pepsi
yeah.
campus.
No internet
for everything.
Pepsi,
yeah,
the world.
It was like I had to walk uphill both ways.
Like the dark
from
ages.
Sands
snow
to get
up to
work.
Your eyes every day.
No, it was really funny. All 32 Tory students would come over to my apartment and sit and watch It's a Wonderful Life for the Christmas party. It was a wonderful time in one way, but it was a really bad time in another way because I have an okay set of gifts and talents, but I don't have an exhaustive list of gifts and talents.
Right, but back then, let's say if you wanted to suddenly change the curriculum in the middle of the semester.
I did.
And you did. You could just notify the 32 people.
Yeah.
That was
and a couple adjuncts.
That was easy to do.
For example, it turns out that I do not have an average interest in books or an average reading speed. So I had everyone reading the entire Fairy Queen for the first semester. And it occurred that these very bright immortals, not all of them either wanted or were capable of reading the entire Fairy Queen
so
in a week.
So people would be weeping. You'd think, I wonder if that was a bad decision.
That was a bad choice.
And at that scale, you could just change the curriculum.
Yeah, that's right. There was, in fact, by intention, no handbook and no rules because I individualized the curriculum for every single student.
It was just ask John Mark.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that's in some ways the way the program should be.
Mm-hmm.
But
there's still some of that in the mentor relationship.
Yeah, in the mentor relationship. So I would like to say that isn't that different. We became official for bad cases.
Mm-hmm.
I don't meet any seniors who have a clue where the handbook is or what's in it. In a good way, because they've worked it out one-on-one with their mentor. Yeah. In many ways, we should have had a handbook. We eventually did have one. But it was mostly one-on-one with John Mark.
Now, mathematically, you could easily see that you should have just hired another person like you. Instead, you went with a bunch of adjuncts doing here a class, there a class. Right? Did you do something like 3 or 4 adjuncts?
Yeah, there were.
Doing a few sessions
here
and there? What was that about?
That was mostly because we couldn't get the funding to bring on a full-time person. But it's also because in the early years, I had to make sure we got the right people. Mm-hmm. And Tory's a weird thing.
Because you hadn't yet explicitly stated what it took to tutor.
Yeah,
you
to
just
tutor.
Kept doing it.
Yeah,
well,
I knew
he started picking us off. All the people that he taught in the graduate program are the people that initially ended up working as adjuncts here.
And some of
so
them,
he was cherry-picking people
some of
that
them
he ran
initially,
into.
Some people we brought in on one-year contracts, for example, eventually we were able to bring on a one-year contract, were awesome scholars and thoughtful people, but they didn't want to sit in a room with 18 to 22-year-olds and lead a discussion about Jane Eyre.
Right, and also, short of being workaholics, they didn't have that sort of startup fire. I mean, the reason Tory succeeded, one of the reasons it succeeded is it had to succeed.
Right.
Because it was the only thing you were here doing.
Right.
So if it took calling hundreds of people,
and it was
you called hundreds
it
of
was,
people.
It was with my family my entire life. So lots of classes were at my house because I wanted to be a good dad. So my kids grew up, you know, crawling around on the floor with Tory students sitting around in a group.
So you can't just hire a normal employee in that situation.
That's exactly right. So
back in Kentucky, I knew a guy who had a mobile car wash business. He'd drive up to your place of business and wash your car in the parking lot, and he was making a fortune on it. So he immediately thought, I'll get another truck and hire someone to do it. And he couldn't find anyone to hire who had the hustle to double his profits.
Yeah. The other problem I ran into was also people that have the kind of gumption to start things often end up hiring people obviously worse than they are at everything. And because that's comfortable, right? They can always have all the ideas and they can be cool. And I knew I didn't want to do that either. But you often attract people that just need jobs, that want you to start something and they want to rinse and repeat. And I knew that if we did that, Tory would die. That if I couldn't be in every class, that if the wingman or wingwoman was obviously inferior to what I was doing, if they couldn't develop their own group of students, that we couldn't expand, that we really should drop back to 16 students. Hmm. But I didn't want to work in a place where I was the smartest person there. Hmm. I knew how not smart I was.
So when did you turn the corner and get funding for full-time people?
In about the third year, the second and third year, we began to get one-year contracts that eventually evolved into tenure track jobs. But my biggest problem right away was theology, because I was hired with an eccentric theological background. I belonged to the same church I belong to now when I was hired by Biola. But even though I agree totally with the entire teaching statement and statement of faith, because I go to such an eccentric church, I was afraid, and in fact think I was having undue influence on the way people viewed the statement of faith or viewed the Bible. And so right away, we needed a theologian.
And so that brings us back around to Phil Johnson again, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that's right. And so we brought in a Talbot-trained theologian who moved from Talbot for a year or two and did an awesome job, you know, keeping us on the straight and narrow and making sure we were doing things. But, you know, the Socratic education, general education at a university as opposed to a seminary or pastoral work, that wasn't their calling. And so I called Phil on the phone and said, I need somebody who's crazy but also has a good PhD in theology who can teach Socratically. And Fred, that's how you ended up here. Phil said, you have to hire, I think he may have liked Susan better than you, mm-hmm. but you have to hire Fred and Susan Sanders. Susan can run the office, and Fred can make theology not stupid.
What does Phil say? How does he tell the story about when John Mark says they need someone? What's his response to Kathy?
We had been doing like a morning Bible study with the Johnsons because we went to the same church in Berkeley, First Pres Berkeley. And Phil liked my comic books. I did the theology comic books right. with InterVarsity back
I
in the
I liked
late
your theology.
90s.
That was my first exposure to you.
And yeah, and what Phil would always say is, what I love about the comics is they tell me just the amount I want to know. I don't want to know any more than that about some of those subjects. And I'd say, yeah, but there's a lot more to know about Luther and Anselm. And he'd say, I don't want to know a lot more. I want what you fit in one comic book page. So, yeah, when you called and said you needed a theologian, I think Kathy Johnson asked, do you think Fred Sanders would fit there? He's looking for work.
Right.
And Phil's response was, hand me the phone.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And then he put that together with some magical grant writing process, again,
yeah, that's right.
with another trip to the Fieldstead Corporation.
Again, thanks to Howard and Roberta Amundsen for re-upping and giving us a grant that made that possible. And then just about simultaneously, I had to look around and say, okay, I have all these wonderful MA Phil graduates. Some of them should go on to do PhDs out of state, and they did. Some of them are doctrinally not where we want to go. They're great people, and they're doing good work for the Lord, all of them, actually, but they're not where we want to go. Who's the best person? Who's the cream of the crop? Who really gets what we're doing? And, Paul, that was you. Do you remember the day I pitched you on the insanity?
Yeah, I do, because I came in, and we were talking about I had taken a class with you on Plato's Republic. And we were chatting, and I said, I needed someone to write me a letter of recommendation, and I was hoping that you would do that. And you said something like, well, would you like to come and teach in Tory? And I thought, he didn't hear me. And I don't know who he's talking to, because I was here for a letter of recommendation. And that's kind of how the craziness started.
Hmm. Yeah. And
so you had an MA Phil in hand, but hadn't enrolled in a PhD program
Hadn't enrolled
yet,
in a
right?
PhD program.
And John Mark offered you a job.
I had a great class with John Mark, and I thought he'd be a great person to write me a letter of rec. I was looking around at places to go. I'd finished the GREs, and John Mark did the thing he did and talked me into staying for a while and launching into this project.
Yeah, it's important when people hear I'm leaving, and I'll point out again, R.A. Torrey only stayed at Biola 12 years. There comes a point where you've done your thing, you know, and it's time to move on. It's time to move on to other fields of ministry. Though I have to say, I hope my other fields of ministry work out better than R.A. Torrey's did after he left Biola. But you don't want to glorify the early days of Torrey. The early days of Torrey, the first two or three years, were awesome for what they were and amazing miracles took place. But if they had continued, right. If we had continued to run the way we were running, huge problems would have developed. We didn't have enough infrastructure support. All decisions can't be made personally by a charismatic leader after a certain point. Once we brought in the next class that was twice as big as the preceding class, Micah Snell, if you're out there, you would be in a class like that. You know, Adam Johnson, who's now teaching theology at Cedarville, would have been in that class. Once you bring in those people, they rightly want things to work better. And so
no more changing the curriculum mid-semester.
That's right. That's crazy. It's not crazy in a startup, because that's showing flexibility to mistakes you made in the original plan. Napoleon, not a very good guy, but he said a very important thing, I think, for leaders, which is when you make a battle plan, you commit yourself and then you see. Which means you make the best plan you can, but then as the battle unfolds, you have to adapt because your plan just goes down the toilet often. And so the good news was that we were able to adapt as we went early on and then stop adapting in crazy ways once we became a more mature organization. So if people are worried about Torrey, I'll point out that Torrey, as anybody really knew it, didn't exist until you two came on board. And, you know, Fred, you didn't radically change the Bible curriculum. We still read the Bible. But, you know, you made it from an eccentric thing that I could teach with 3 years of Bible college to something that would be credible to Talbot. Hmm. And Paul, in the same way with your philosophy of ed background, so we read Sheldon Van Auken. Why did we read Sheldon Van Auken? Because he had been influential as a mentor in my life. I didn't think he was a great writer. I didn't think that he would stay in the curriculum. I just needed somebody that I could teach well and that would minister to students in an appropriate way.
And had the
way.
Right kind of information that the students needed.
Yeah, that's correct. And so...
So when I got here in 99, Paul had already done quite a bit of tutoring.
Yeah, that's correct.
Did you have a 1 year the year before that?
Yeah.
Okay, and then when I got here in 99,
you
also went
to... Yeah, I'm the one that picked you up at the airport.
Exactly.
And we knew that we liked each other because we were exchanging Simpsons riffs, if I remember correctly. So I'm like, oh, yeah, these guys are.
Dan Yum was already on the ground
here
and had already done a 1 year, or at least had done a bunch of tutoring.
Yeah that's right.
Lizo, of course.
Yes, that's right. Thomas Lizo had taught full-time, part-time for a long time because he was also going to school at Claremont, finishing up a PhD. We had a lot of success.
Blander and Lehman were... Blander was already kind of moving on.
That's right.
Right when you got here.
And then Lehman got here to
as a writing director to help with writing. And so we owe a lot to all of those people. Josh was reminding me, I gave a paper and was talking to him at the King's College, where he is right now, that he would like to be remembered in the institutional history because he did a good job for us. Josh describes himself as the McPhee, if you know that hideous strength of the early years of Torrey. I tend to be very purple, and I really do think we're going to save the West. I really think what we're doing is important, but often that can become pompous and overly grand. And Josh Blander's job a lot was to stick a pin in my pomposity, in my purple prose, and say, yeah, you know, we're just a Great Books Honors program at Biola, right? We're not Harvard.
Right, and 99 Yim sort of took over a little bit of that role.
Yeah, the
Josh.
McPhee role, yeah. And it was a good role. We needed that around, and we still have people that perform that function for us. Well, we could talk about this sort of thing for a long time, but our sole remaining listener, my mother, is tired of listening to this, I'm sure. So for one of the last times, this is John Mark Reynolds for Middlebrow, a service of Scriptorium Daily.